Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable, and thank you very much for being with us. It's Friday. It's Friday, and isn't that nice?
And happy Valentine's Day.
Yes, and it's Valentine's Day. It is the 14th of February. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. I hope the spirit of love is in the air in your life, and that you can enjoy it however you can. You know, it was a stormy weather for the weekend, but that won't keep us from celebrating the holiday today. And I don't know, is it a holiday? It's a commemorance, right? Wait, is that what it is?
Holiday.
A holiday? Is a holiday? Okay. So happy Valentine's Day to everyone, and we welcome you. We are don't expect us to be all full of love though. We'll still be our snarky selves. We have a great group this morning. Let me introduce you to them, and we'll get started. We welcome Jay Jochnowitz to the program. Jay is semi-retired, but when he's not semi-retired, he's an editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union. Jay, good morning. How are you?
To quote James Brown, I feel good.
Excellent. That is...
I knew that I would.
I'm not sure that I believe you, but I will take it. That's very, very good. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan in the house. Hello, Heather. How are you?
My mic's not on.
Oh, there you go.
No, I turned my own mic.
No, you know what you want to do? Hold on. We're gonna work this out with you.
Okay.
I'm going to move this.
Okay.
And then go to five.
Five?
Go to five. I think you're on five. And then, there you go. You can hear
it. Now it's back to off.
There you
now
go.
Now it's off.
I don't know what the hell.
It's a crazy morning.
Yeah, it is. that's five.
Is
okay,
it on?
I get it. Yeah, you're on.
Okay, I'm on.
You're
good
on.
Morning.
Yeah. By the way, welcome to rehearsal.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Just one big rehearsal, isn't it?
It really is. Give you a little sense of how things are going today. Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Yeah.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Yeah. I'm in the sweet spot of the year where you never know when you wake up if you have to take the blankets off the horses or put them on. Ugh. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's absolutely true. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So they're off. They're going on later.
Okay. Yeah.
And then they'll be off again this weekend, you know, but.
Yeah, it's going to go up and down.
Yeah.
At least they've...
It does keep me entertained.
They're blanketed and ready.
Yeah.
Yes. <that's>... Judy Patrick is here, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am great, and encourage people to listen to the Media Project today. We got a great one we recorded yesterday. Lots of fun, lots of really important content. It was me, Miles Reed from The Gazette, Ian Pickus from WAMC, and Rex. We had a good time doing it and some important conversation. 3 o'clock.
Stirred up?
Stirred it
There's
up.
There's a lot
Excellent.
To talk about there.
Oh, yeah.
I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. It's good. Well, that'll be great. Yeah, 3 o'clock this afternoon and then on Sunday at 6. So,
correct. Yeah.
You have a many chances and, of course, anytime online at WAMC.org. So we look forward to hearing that. All right, let's get right to it and talk about the topics for the day. And, let us start with the Manhattan federal prosecutor, Danielle Sassoon.
Ooh la la.
Yes, indeed. Manhattan's federal prosecutor, Danielle Sassoon, the interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, quit yesterday. And she said... the reason was because of the Justice Department ordering charges against the mayor of New York City, the Big Apple, Eric Adams, to be dropped. And she, along with five officials with the federal, get the name of this unit, the Public Integrity Unit, quit after the Justice Department ordered those charges to be dropped. When Justice Department officials transferred the case to the Public Integrity Section in Washington, which oversees corruption prosecutions, the two men who led that unit also resigned, according to five people with knowledge of the matter. Several hours later, three other lawyers in the unit also resigned, according to people familiar with the developments. The serial resignations represent the most high-profile public opposition so far to President Trump's tightening control over the Justice Department. They were a stunning repudiation of the administration's attempt to force the dismissal of the charges against Mayor Adams. The departures of the U.S. attorney, Danielle Sassoon, and the officials who oversaw the Justice Department's public integrity section, Kevin O'Driscoll and John Keller, came in rapid succession on Thursday. Days earlier, the acting number two official of the Justice Department, Emil Bove, had ordered Manhattan prosecutors to drop the case against Mr. Adams. The agency's justification for dropping the case was explicitly political. Mr. Bove had argued that the investigation would prevent Mr. Adams from fully cooperating with Mr. Trump's immigration crackdown. Mr. Bove made a point of saying that Washington officials had not evaluated the strength of the evidence or the legal theory of the case. So, in other words, they had to keep him on because they needed some help in the garage. Right? Like
Well, I mean, I think it's a parallel to the argument or the practice of not prosecuting a sitting president, that it disrupts their ability to carry out their duties. This is just honestly the most out there. I'm using the word transparent in the like we're seeing stuff we don't usually see kind of swap meet. But the underlying argument is, you know, here you have the chief executive of the largest city in the United States, arguably a pretty important economic engine, arguably has been very much struggling with the influx of undocumented individuals, whether they were sent here by other states or whatever. And there's this big friction between the city and the federal government over money and housing and all of that. That's really the whole context of it. Now, the question about the prosecutors quitting their jobs, I mean, yeah, if they don't agree with it and they feel like they can't carry out the command, I guess that's the high profile thing to do. Put it in the paper and quit your job. But to me, the idea of them saying out loud, well, we think this is going to disrupt his ability to help with, the immigration thing. I don't find that shocking because I kind of expected they would ask him to anyways. So that to me is not a stunner.
I think when you read her resignation letter and you see the three key words, quid pro quo in there, you realize how serious this is. Serious. Is it going to be enduring? Are there going to be more people in the Trump administration and particularly in the Justice Department, and later I think we'll see them in the FBI, who were handpicked by outfits like the Heritage Foundation, which apparently has a list of 54,000 people waiting to take jobs in this administration, presumably all MAGA loyalists just waiting to fulfill Trump's mandates. This is something that really went awry as far as the president's agenda is concerned. And I that's why I quoted the immortal philosopher James Brown.
But I would love to talk through the quid pro quo aspect of it, because that's interesting to me. But I think, I mean, obviously, Judy is going to have something to say here.
Well, I think Trump said to Adams, we're going to make the Justice Department make this case go away, and in return, you are going to make it easy for me to go and get immigrants out of your city. I think that's as simple as that.
And whatever else, right? Yeah. I mean, have New York City sort of friendly territory again, which it was not for a very long time.
You're not only going to do it, but I'm not going to completely take these charges away from you. I'm going to have them hanging over your head for the rest of your political career if you don't do what I say.
So do I think that's right? No, I don't think it's right. I think decisions should be made on the merits of the case. It could very well be important for New York City to cooperate with the federal government or not. But I think the case itself should have stood on its own. I think they're trying to hollow out the federal government so they can fill it back in with people who are loyal to Donald Trump. Is it equivalent to the Saturday Night Massacre during the Nixon administration? I don't know. It certainly isn't being played as aggressively in the media as the Saturday Night Massacre back in the 70s.
Well, it's more like a...
Maybe explain the context of the Saturday Night Massacre.
So when during the Nixon administration, there was this effort by the Attorney General to make the Watergate tapes available, and when they refused to comply with Nixon's order, rather than do that, they got fired. I think I don't think they resigned voluntarily, and one after another, I think I had two or three attorney generals just step away because they were not going to enact or follow an unlawful order. I mean, it's people standing up to power. We had a little bit of the same thing early on in the Trump administration where people would resign rather than do things they thought were unlawful. And you know what? In any administration, that happens where people say, I just can't do this. But the idea that we can't prosecute anybody sitting in office, a mayor, a town councilman, just because they're in office or happen to be running for office or re-election. They're always running for re-election. And so that would be, as long as you're elected, no corruption can be filed against you. That's just wrong.
It's amazing to me, and I this may come off more negative than I mean it to sound, but I don't think it'll come off any other way, which is, It seems like many are looking at these five people, and especially Sassoon, as, oh my God, there's someone who has a spine. Oh goodness gracious, where did that come from? Because we haven't had that for 10 years.
Well, we did. We had a few exceptions.
No, we
out
did.
There. We
You're
had
right.
Sally Yates. Yeah. We had Vindman. We had people in the Justice Department that threatened to resign over the January 6th.
Well, a lot of nonsense. People, yeah, a lot of people yeah. resigned after January 6th, but it was on their last day.
Yeah, but we haven't seen it, I don't think, in this administration, in this new Trump 2.0 administration, and we haven't seen it on this scale. This isn't just a few random people out there in the wilderness. This is a U.S. attorney, an acting U.S. attorney, and multiple people from the Public Integrity Unit. I was surprised that they did not vet these people more carefully.
Well, they were, and she was internal.
Yeah.
She was internal, and she has a very high-profile history. Like, she, I think, did the Sam Bankman-Fried case.
Yeah.
At least she worked on it.
She clerked for Scalia?
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely somebody that...
Conservative, we should note.
Maybe. Who cares? I have this issue with,
okay.
with you know, somehow someone is lesser because they're liberal or because they're conservative. I think they're different viewpoints, and there can be valid viewpoints on both sides.
Oh, but, absolutely. But she's not out there. Liberal.
No. But I will say, and I agree with Judy, that you should not be totally free from prosecution when you sit in office. However, in recent years, in my view, and when I say recent, I mean, let's go back like 15 or so, particularly in New York, prosecutions have been used as a tool to bring down political figures on some of the most specious of evidence. I mean, I think of there was a senator in the Southern Tier who was forced to resign from office and threatened with jail time because when the FBI asked him, did he help his son get a job, he said no. Mm. Not under oath. Not required to be under oath, but apparently it is a felony to lie to the FBI. I challenge you to find another case before that where someone was prosecuted for something that was a casual conversation. It was very much politically motivated. There's a history of this, and what they've done with the Eric Adams case is, to me, a parallel of the mistakes that were made with the Trump case. They dragged it out to try and gain some political value out of it because this is an election year. And so, you know, it's the slow unwrapping of the presents, and then this one, and oh, they raided this one's house, and oh, and you know, let's build this all up to the grand indictment, and it's all timed and it's all very specific. I worked in a prosecutor's office. You know, if you're doing a long-term investigation, you usually don't announce each step of the way. The only reason you do it is because you want to get some kind of reaction from the people who are being investigated, and I think that they misplayed it. Now, I'm not saying she was wrong to resign. She may be right to resign. And I'm not saying that it is right to dismiss the charges. But I'm saying the context is very muddy here. It is this to me, it has clearly been handled in a political way. So, you know, if the flip side of it is you have to capitulate and help me out on this immigration stuff, he's been asking for help before this. He's been asking for help from the federal government during the Biden administration. He was asking for help. So I'm not sure that he was forced into a position that he didn't want to take. I mean, maybe it's more than he wants to do, but, you know, he's also a former law enforcement official. So he may see things more from the same viewpoint as the Trump administration. I don't know. I don't mean to speak for him, but I think there's a lot more context than what some of the reporting has been, and or there's different ways to look at it.
One correction on that: the leaks, she points out in her own memo, the leaks did not come from the prosecution. The leaks came from the defense. So any manipulation of the press that was going on here, any manipulation of public opinion. Some of the manipulation, because obviously, if you're arresting people along the way, that's as good as a leak.
You're
kind of making an announcement there. But the leaks that were coming out that were intended to be damaging were coming from the defense.
I mean, some of the information that was out there about folks who worked around him was the pressure that was being placed upon them was immense, immense. And I mean, the power of a prosecution to destroy a person's life can't be understated. I mean, it really can't. You can't unring that bell once you've been indicted. It's the whole, where do you go to get your reputation back?
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We'll welcome your letters as well. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Heather Mulligan is here, Jay Jochnowitz, and Judy Patrick. We welcome your thoughts. We're going to continue, and we'll go to letters. We'll talk more about this case, and then, of course, we have lots of other stuff to discuss as well. All of that coming up. Again, it's panel@wamc.org, and we'll continue after this short break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the show. Bad news for both Heather and Jay. You're going to have to stop talking about horse poop.
Good news for me.
Usually the conversation just continues in a political way, but no, we got into.
Well, this is a way better topic.
Yeah, no, I guess.
Yeah.
Very graphic, very good stuff.
That's right.
Absolutely. I used to get my best work done in the morning shoveling poop, and I would often say in the editorial board meeting, the first thing I would introduce a topic by saying, so I was shoveling manure this morning, and it hit me that we could write an editorial about.
Yeah,
it's just practice. It's all practice. Yeah. I mean, I'm a registered lobbyist. That's what advocacy is, right?
A little known fact, but the the working title of the show originally was Shoveling Manure.
Really?
Yeah. So wow. We changed it, and this seems to have caught on better.
Did you have T-shirts?
Wow.
Didn't reach that stage. Yeah.
S&M.
Good morning.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, there's
Jack,
the right
please.
Turn I wasn't expecting.
Jay Jackson with Heather Mulligan and Judy Patrick. Send your letters there. All right, so we're talking about what happened in Manhattan, and it is a fascinating story in many respects. I one has to wonder of how now brown cow.
Get out of my head.
How now? Give the farm metaphors I assume Trump will exact some sort of revenge.
Oh, it's going to be nasty, nasty truths,
yes.
As they call them.
Yes.
And it isn't over. I mean, first they have to find a lackey willing to do this. And then they have to convince a judge, as she pointed out. She didn't even think this would necessarily fly in a court to go in and say, here's the reasons we're doing it. And the judge may well have said, no, I don't accept that. And we've seen that. We saw it in the Hussein case or up here with the limo crash where a deal had been worked out and they went in and it was community service and no jail time. And the judge, Peter Lynch, said, no. I'm not going to accept this. This is a miscarriage of justice. Now, in that case, the confession had already been made and the judge knew it. In this case, you know, it's the weight of the evidence, which she feels is very strong. So, you know, it may not even get that far. But, yeah, I think this is going to cause some people in the administration to have a lot of rethinking about who they've hired, you know, whether there's going to be a new round of loyalty checks and so forth. I don't know. But they don't like that. I'm sure he doesn't like this embarrassment. This is an embarrassment.
And she was elevated from within. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, we said that already. But so she wasn't someone who came and was plopped in there as a Trump appointee. You know, I think that person is still waiting to be, I don't know if they need to be approved. So, you know, she was acting. So who knows if she was going to stay anyways? I don't know.
Right. There may be some attacks on her pension or, I mean, that they go that route or they go, you know, the trite, mean kind of route. But because I think they need to make a point that this is not going to be tolerated, this kind of standing up and rejecting an order from above. But it may be a blip. I'm sure we're going to be talking about something different tomorrow, Sunday, Monday. It just never stops. The stuff keeps coming down the
spaghetti fest. Yeah. It's like everything is thrown at the wall all at once, and you have to pick which strand you want to talk about.
The and then of course, you know, it brings in the whole Eric Adams and re-election and his race and what he's doing now and. It's all quite fascinating because he's operating as if nothing happened.
And as if he's actually got a chance at this point. Maybe he does. I mean, look, we could have a race with Eric Adams and Andrew Cuomo.
I don't see that.
I mean, just this amazing redemption ticket.
Eric Adams as a Republican?
I don't see that happening. I mean, I think he's probably got an exit strategy, but if you're in charge of a city like New York, or if you're in charge of a state or any large governmental entity, you can't announce that you're not going to run again. You know, I mean, in order to govern, you have to act like you're all hands on deck going to run again if you want to have any kind of ability to wield influence. And New York is a tough city to govern to begin with, right? So but I don't. I just don't. I can't imagine he's going to run again. I think once that becomes clear, and it may not become clear to us, it may become clear to others. Like when petitions are filed, we'll know if he's running again. If Andrew Cuomo files petitions, I think we'll know Eric Adams is not running. you know, so I don't see them both running as Democrats. I just don't. I mean, maybe Adams goes to the Republican side, but I just don't believe that would happen either.
That would be a hell of a matchup. I mean, the two of them facing each other.
Cuomo would win probably in a blowout. I mean, I had a poll of one person.
but
I acknowledge that.
Wrong one person.
No, I had an Uber driver. I had to go to an event probably right after the new year. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. It was within the last 4 weeks. And I always talk to Uber drivers. I just think it's interesting. I want to know, do you do this full time? You know, where are you from? And the guy lives in the Bronx. His kids are up here. And he was visiting his kids for an extended period of time because he has grandkids and he wanted to spend time with them. So during the day when everyone's at work and school, he's driving an Uber around. And I'm like, oh, I said, you know, what do you think of your mayor's race? He's like, if I could vote for Andrew Cuomo right now, I would in 10 seconds. And I'm a diehard Democrat. He said, I don't know anybody who wouldn't vote for Andrew Cuomo right now. I mean, the view of him, we all, you know, we live in a specific little media bubble. But the view of him in New York City is a lot different than it is up here. And the polling shows it, right? I mean, he's polling without having announced anything, without having said five things about what he would do as mayor. He's polling at 38%. And the next highest person is, what, 18? And I think that's Eric Adams, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just, I'm not saying the election is over, but, but I think, I don't think they run against each other. I just don't see it.
Let's go to some letters on the subject and then we'll take a break. Hello, panel. Hochul was the absolute power to suspend, has the absolute power to suspend Adams. There is a 30-day period where both sides defend their positions and removal could proceed from there. She is wishy-washy, worrying about her own reelection, eroding support, and Trump retribution. Meanwhile, Adams is completely compromised and under the orange thumb for well over a year. Your move, Kathy Hochul.
No, she should never do that. No way.
No, the voters are going to decide one. And she was in for an editorial board meeting last weekend, if I remember the conversation right. We didn't talk a lot about Adams, but I think her sense was, I need to work with the mayor right now.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of problems here. This is not...
not helpful. It would not help anything in terms of what's going on in the city. And in terms of dealing with things like the MTA budget hole and all the things that are on their plate right now, removing the mayor would be wrong for a lot of reasons.
Let's go back to letters. And you know how much Trump dislikes Andrew Cuomo. Come on, you must realize that he is motivated to keep Cuomo away from becoming mayor of New York City.
I don't think so. I think he sees him as someone else who's been wrongly accused, and you know, I think that there's probably they have a lot more in common than they don't.
You're probably right.
He sees Andrew Cuomo as somebody he can work with.
I think
Andrew Cuomo would simply say, "This is the person who's the president. This is who I have to work with," and I'm not going to do my Andrew Cuomo imitation, and I'll deal with it. that would be Cuomo. Yeah. And he might more often than not speak out. Certainly more than Eric Adams is likely to. But I don't think that would be an issue.
We have this letter from David who says, could the panel provide some perspective on the merit of resigning in protest versus staying to keep a person of integrity in office? Doesn't the resignation make it easier for the Musk administration to fill spots with yes men?
But she was asked to do something she thought was fundamentally wrong. That's not how you that made her staying in office untenable.
And it's that or be fired.
Yeah.
If you don't do it, but it's also a way to do it that it's a public statement. You know, if you wait, you get fired, and then you say something. You're like, "Oh, it's a disgruntled former employee." Right.
That's
right. Do you stand on principle and stay in an office and do things that you don't believe in, but with the intention of trying to reform from within, or do you go out? I mean, in this media environment, so she's got one day of attention, and that will disappear. Could she have been more effective? I mean, she was a pretty good prosecutor, according to her background. She may have been more effective to stay put, but they were asking her to do something, and she was defying them. And just like Sally Yates, she had to step away.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll return to this, get a couple more letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org is how you reach us. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Like this music. House of Hamel is who we're playing this morning. Playlist posted online, WAMC.org. You can find it there. You can also go to panel at WAMC.org if you would like to write in and talk to us about any of the issues that we're discussing this morning. And before we leave this issue, so what happens next?
I think they find someone to do what they want. Maybe. Heather would know this better than I do. I don't know how the Justice Department works whether you can just pick a random attorney in the Justice Department to say, you are now assigned to the case, go into court and get it dropped.
I honestly don't know the answer to that, but a judge can object to the withdrawal, but a prosecutor ultimately controls whether the case is prosecuted or not, the office itself. And let's not forget for a moment that an indictment and the standards for an indictment and the standards for a conviction are light years apart. You know, there's the famous saying, you can indict a ham sandwich, meaning, I mean, for an indictment for a felony, you need probable cause that a crime was committed, which is usually, you know, there's a dead body or there's a bag of weed, or, well, not weed now, cocaine or something, right? And you need probable cause that this is the person that committed it. And I think they have weakness in the probable cause issue on the crime was committed aspect of it, because ultimately, from what's at least been leaked or is out there, this is about upgrades on flights. And you would have to establish that the only reason that he expedited or tried to expedite these building permits was so he could get updates on flights. And I think that's a virtually impossible thing to prove unless you've got some, you know, magic wand. A good defense attorney would pick that indictment apart in a heartbeat. So there could be some really easy ways to do this without having – it might be that the directive from above is a bigger problem than – the actual dismissal of it itself. But I think that they've really put themselves in a bind, the office has, because of the timing of everything. Even if they wanted to dismiss it, which they don't, you know, everyone in New York City, like not everyone, but a lot of people dislike Eric Adams. So they'd be unpopular if they were to just outright dismiss it and people would cry foul. I don't know what else they could do other than just let it play out as if, yeah, the person who comes in who's been ordered to do this just does it and moves on, right? There's a way to do it, though. I mean, they could find someone inside the office who just wants to have the title for a day and is willing to say, yeah, okay, I'll do this.
Yeah, that case is going away. They could just slow walk it and fail to file proper papers when they're supposed to. But, you know, we do need to have at some point in going forward a discussion about public corruption and what our laws are and why they don't work now, or maybe they do, and what we should do to be fair to public officials and just to make sure that people who are elected to positions of authority in our government do so with integrity and honesty. I know that sounds naive, but our laws are not working for us now, I think, and we need to take a harder look at what works, what doesn't, and what's fair and in the best interests of all concerned.
I
was just going to say, I think Congress has really struggled with how do you define what is, you know, like the abuse of office. Having a nicer parking spot, having a bigger office, having a car, having an Air Force One at your disposal. Those are perks that ordinary people don't get, right? Is it legal or illegal for someone to be able to sit in a stadium for free or throw out the first pitch at a baseball game? And to me, like, those are almost silly questions. I think the real question is, are you taking actual bribes to do something you wouldn't otherwise do, right? And there's very different things. Like, what are you doing in your capacity in your office versus are you doing something special for some special benefit? But it's hard to define, right?
Yeah.
There was a bit more here than the upgrades.
Okay, and I'm sorry. I was being very flip with that.
No,
I apologize.
No, but it's important to – and I was trying to remember what else – because there were some other serious things in there, one of which was – and this is a big problem in New York City and, you know, for New York State as well with its public finance system, the implications of it was that he was leveraging foreign donations, which were illegal to begin with, into – what the number I read was $10 million worth of public funds. So the allegation is that they fraudulently tried to.
But isn't that what some of his employees are charged with, or is that what he's charged
with? Right, and does he have the plausible deniability there in a situation where she said, not only in her exit memo or in the memo that she wrote, she said not only does she think the case is strong enough to begin with that there was enough probable cause there, but there was enough there for a superseding indictment on obstruction in the way that he tried to eliminate evidence.
Yeah, see, I'm not. But I thought the only thing he'd actually himself been charged with was the upgrades on the plane tickets.
Yeah, there's a whole aura of corruption around this, which is probably why he would lose an election in New York, in New York City. All the more reason because he was trying to game a system that really people don't want to see gamed. And I think there was just one. Oh, and the other issue was, and it's no small matter in New York City that, regardless of the value of anything he was doing, the end result was that apparently he made a phone call to a fire commissioner and said, "I don't care if the thing's a fire trap. Go ahead." And he didn't put it this way, but
the certificate
but
of
fundamentally,
occupancy. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Cool if he did. Yeah.
We don't need a fire inspection. Go ahead and approve the thing because the Turks want to open it and show it off real fast. If there had been a fire that night, we wouldn't even be having. This is not the discussion we'd be having. We'd be talking about possibly accessory to manslaughter.
Connecting that to the ticket upgrades. I mean, mm-hmm. as a mayor, you've got all these diplomats in the city. You want them to feel like they've got your ear and they have the ability to talk to you. And there's definitely bureaucratic nonsense that happens on, and some of it is, you know, important and some of it isn't. But to me, it's not crazy that someone would say, "Oh my God, I'm having this problem. You know, could you help me out?" And you're like, "Oh, this is, you know, this is the ambassador from I don't know wherever. Mm-hmm. Let me look into it." Yeah. That's different than saying just move forward. Mm-hmm. I get that, but I don't. I don't know that I see like a criminal mind there. But mm-hmm. but you know, I'm just speculating.
Yeah.
I guess
corrupt, but. You know, how criminal it was. I mean, you know, not criminal like a gaudy criminal.
Yeah.
The bottom line is we're never going to know because this is all going to go away.
Yep.
You seem so sad.
I'm a realist.
Maybe some enterprising reporter will do a Freedom of Information request and tear the whole thing apart and see what there was.
Maybe. A couple of letters and then we'll go to a break. Let's see. It's not the one I wanted. Where's the letter that I thought? There we go. Mayor Adams was elected primarily to fight crime in New York, and that is what he has been doing. He has also spoken out against the Biden administration's woeful failure to enforce order at our southern border, flooding New York with undocumented immigrants who, by New York's compassionate laws, were entitled to free housing, including hotel rooms. I am a Trump opponent, but praise his administration for dropping these flimsy charges against Mayor Adams. It gives me hope.
Well, that person said what I kind of said before way better than I said it.
We go to Glenn. Elon Musk has billions invested doing business in China. Nobody operates at that level in China without being leveraged by the Chinese Communist Party. You don't think that's a quid pro quo relationship where China says do this if you want to do that? Like, have your tech bros and there's words missing. Implanting malware in U.S. government software systems for use at some future day, or we shut you down, or doesn't it work that way? It's a quid pro quo.
That's
question.
Pretty conspiratorial. Are they that malevolent? I think they're malevolent in a lot of ways. I don't know that they're malevolent to that point, although I've certainly seen the speculation out there on Facebook. There's a reason we have national security laws and security checks and restrictions and all that, and who knows? This is a bunch of 20-somethings. It's crazy.
There's a reason we have ethics laws and public integrity units. They seem to be being dismantled. I think we're American public in general is accepting the fact that, oh yeah, government's transactional. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way business operates. Of course, this we're getting away from the idea of government providing basic services to people. And so we have a functioning society.
And we did have, to his point, we just had an order from the president suspending the anti-bribery statutes overseas. So if you're, and this has always been a real puzzler, that if you're, you know, a company doing business in a country where bribery is pretty much how you get stuff done, you're not allowed to do it. You could be prosecuted over here for doing it. And
there's a country I used to vacation to all the time. I've been to multiple times. I won't name the country because I don't want to besmirch them, and they may have cleaned up their act. But when I was considering buying a piece of property and was told point blank, well, the first thing you need to do is bribe this local official. You have to, like, and it wasn't described as a bribe. It was like you have to make a gift, and it has to be significant.
Wow.
And it has to be a gift of a certain size, and here's what the size would be based on what, you know. I mean, it was
very,
and that's just how you do it, you know.
Florida?
No.
All right. Let's see, I promise one more letter. Sounds like the panel doesn't fly business or first class very often. If they did, they'd realize that upgrades from economy are worth thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah, I've never flown.
I got upgraded once, and it was awesome.
I did too. It's really nice.
we were planning a trip overseas, and I looked at all the seats in the back, you know, by the bathroom, and I was clicking on those things, and then they said, oh, there are these seats available, and I went up to like the little pods at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like, oh, you know, that's only additional $8,000.
Oof.
I was like, man, all right.
Deal.
Yeah. Sign me up.
Well, I flew one time to Ireland for like $300 on this airline that no longer is flying. They were flying like out of Newburgh. Stewart, yeah. And it was like pretty much lawn chairs. Like, you know, bring your paper bag lunch.
Oh, I was on that flight. Oh, my God. Yeah. It was like bleachers at a kid's.
You get what you pay for.
Like at an elementary school, quote unquote, stadium. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We'll welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org. First, we have a break, and then news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 14th of February, otherwise known as St. Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. And we wish you a happy Valentine's Day, one and all. Let me reestablish, as we say in the business, to our wonderful panel this morning. Judy Patrick is with us. Jay Jochnowitz and Heather Mulligan, and of course we welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's go to other topics. We had been talking about the Eric Adams case, and now we'll move to the incredibly sexy topic of reciprocal tariffs.
I know you are, but what am I?
Yes. get ready. Okay. So this has been in the works. This has been promised for several days from the administration. President Trump on Thursday set in motion a plan for new tariffs on other countries globally, an ambitious move that could shatter the rules of global trading and is likely to set off furious negotiations. The president directed his advisors to come up with new tariff levels that take into account a range of trade barriers and other economic approaches adopted by America's trading partners. That includes not only the tariffs that other countries charge the United States, but also the taxes they charge on foreign products, the subsidies they give their industries, their exchange rates, and other behaviors the president deems unfair. The president has said the step was necessary to even out America's quote-unquote unfair relationships and stop other countries from taking advantage of the United States on trade, but he made clear that his ultimate goal was to force companies to bring their manufacturing back to the United States of America, reading from the New York Times.
And you know, it is a fair question, and we have been long before Trump, we were writing about this editorially on, you know, what is the way to do this? What is the way to accomplish this? We do need to bring manufacturing back as much as possible, you know, acknowledging that there is extraordinarily cheap labor around the world, that we are never going to be able to, you know, we just can't match that. And, you know, so how do we create the incentives here at home without violating other countries? Well, global trade, you know, how do we do that without violating global standards for what government support of industry is, and you know, how unfair, how that can be perceived and can be legally unfair. We accuse China of it, of supporting their industry so that prices stay artificially low. It is such, I'm going to babble because it's such a complicated.
Answer.
You do.
Absolutely.
Heather has the answer. I'm going to yield the floor.
All right.
Wow. Said with sarcasm. I'm sorry. I'll give you the mic first if you want. So I think fundamentally free trade is the goal that any commerce association, which I am, the Business Council, mm-hmm. it's the State Chamber of Commerce, and the State Manufacturing Association. Free trade is the gold standard. But you need free trade with guardrails because, as you noted, other countries do things like subsidize or don't have environmental protections or don't have labor protections or have, you know, or do things like intentionally steal, rip off, and duplicate items that are sold in the U.S. and then subsidize it with the clear intent of putting those companies out of business so that they can purchase them. Take a look at the furniture industry. That is exactly what happened. So the answer is trade agreements, and trade agreements that are built on rational principles of the things that you think matter competitively. If you're a paper manufacturer in New York and you are operating under a system that severely limits the amount of trees that you can take at any given time, that severely limits the chemicals that you can use in the process, that, and yet paper coming in from other countries is being purchased by governmental entities because under their bidding rules, they have to buy the cheapest one despite the fact there. And there's no adjustment to price on these. So the paper comes in, state says, OGS rules say you have to buy the cheapest one and look at the savings. And the savings, taxpayer dollar, is penultimate, right? Paper company goes out of business. True story, right? This is a true story. So there are places with trade agreements where you can adjust and you can have tariffs based on different policies, different values. And USMCA, we worked really, really hard in getting our congressional delegation to support USMCA because our largest trading partner is Canada. And there is so much cross-border manufacturing that goes on between New York and Canada. A blanket tariff is just an added cost. It's a glitch. It slows things down. If it's not attached to some principles, if it's not attached to some values, it really is used for leverage. And that's kind of what is going on with the Canada-Mexico stuff, right? The president, I always think in terms of governor, is trying to leverage what's there, despite the fact that the USMCA was negotiated on his watch. Right. We need to have trade agreements with everyone. Free trade agreements. Free with the qualifier that you have to have guardrails to adjust for the things that matter to you. They want to do a value-added tax, do a value-added tax. The reciprocity thing, I think, I know you are, but what am I? Ultimately, it's a blunt instrument that theoretically could have the effect of driving some manufacturing back here because everything else, the price advantage that they have, people will maybe not buy something that was imported if they can buy it and it's made here. But there's a lot of things that aren't made here. Mm-hmm. That's why you got to have these agreements, right? So, long-winded, but the solution is trade agreements that are thoughtfully negotiated and entered into. And I know immediately after USMCA, our organization, the Business Council, spoke to representatives from both Great Britain. Now I'm going to blank out on who the other country is. I forget who it was. So there's another country came in saying, can you help us push forward some trade agreements, you know, the way that you guys, and of course I will note that the folks on the Democratic side of the aisle who voted for USMCA when Trump was president lost their seats. So they were punished for basically what was a very good negotiated trade agreement. But that's the oppositional politics. If, you know, if it was vice versa and Biden was president when it got negotiated and Republicans had voted for it, you know, that then it would be bad, you know. So
well, is there any validity to the – I mean, you pointed out yourself this was negotiated on his watch.
Yeah.
Is there any validity to why you're negotiating it now? Wasn't it a perfect – didn't you say it was perfect?
Well, but you do with any of these, yeah. You do and next year they have a term. And halfway through the term, there is a process by which you relook at it and you adjust and you change. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, USMCA, the real concern is some of the labor protections south of the border that are supposed to be being adhered to that are not. Mm-hmm. On the Canadian side, I'm not sure that there was a lot of I know that there's a lot of disagreement around technology. But I'm not educated enough to actually articulate what that is. But as I understand it, the big point of friction that you would adjust, and that is an ordinary process, is you go back and you look mm-hmm. at after like 10 years, you say, okay, I'm going to – or maybe five. I can't remember how long it is. But it's a fixed period of time. Halfway through, you look at the agreement and you say, what do we need to change to fix this and mm-hmm. adjust it? And then you extend it. You know, or you live with it as changed for the rest of the term.
Right. What you're describing seems logical, and I think it's something every American would support and think is a good idea. But this is what happens, as with the effort to provide cost efficiency in federal government. It's this wholesale approach to reciprocal trade agreements that's the danger, and that there's concern that it's not being well thought out, that the implications to what American spending habits has not been looked at, that nobody even cares about it. But maybe that's just all theater. I mean, maybe apparently they've been given until April 1st or 180 days or something like that to come up with all of these agreements. Is that enough time? Is this just posturing again? And is this how the administration will go forward? The problem, from my perspective, is the fact that it doesn't give me a lot of confidence that right will be done, that the trade agreements will actually be good for American industry and American businesses and will be good for the American consumers, that other interests will be served instead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think the whole, like, we're just going to apply the I know you are, but what am I tariffs across the board is definitely, like, that's the most simplistic, quickest, easiest way, but it leaves out so much. Like, it sets aside the existing trade agreements, for starters. And the argument about, well, you shouldn't have different tariffs for different countries, I don't know that that's true. I think maybe you should, depending on the product, depending, you know, if you start looking at why you might. But I think the ultimate goal has to be free trade with a level playing field, right? So, but the devil's in the detail of figuring out what are the policy things that you care about. Is it the environmental protections? Should they be, you know, how do you factor in the fact that there's, you know, you can clear cut in some countries and you certainly can't do that in the U.S.? How do you factor in the price or abusive labor practices in other countries, and the protections here? Like, that's hard work, mm-hmm. and that's why USMCA took so long. This is, you know, a much faster route to basically say get everyone's attention. We'll see what happens. I'm not overly confident that it's going to result in the most thoughtful outcome.
Right. And isn't it going to take a little bit of time for new computer chip manufacturing facilities to be built, car plants to be built? I mean, the kind of manufacturing that produces the most effective outcome for U.S. citizens. It takes a while. It's not like these. I know we have a lot of empty mill buildings, but they need to be retrofitted in a major way or demolished and built anew. I mean, this is a long-term process. So I don't see the short-term game for President Trump on this.
It's, well, he's, you know, in theory, right, he's only in for one term. He's trying to get a lot of stuff done all at once, and then when it eventually happens, he'll get the credit for it.
His legacy. Christopher's library.
I guess. I don't know. I don't know. It's getting stuff done, right?
I kind of thought the operative...
Seems like a plan.
The operative word was hard work, that this is hard work. And he's not known for that, it seems. So this is a blunt instrument to use.
Yeah.
And he's happy about that. I go back to... I made a note on this because I knew I was going to forget it, that if the ultimate goal is to bring manufacturing back, why, for example, haven't the reduced corporate tax rates worked? That was one of the things that we'd been writing about for a number of years.
Our corporate tax rates are still not the lowest in the world, not even close.
They're absolutely not, but they are lower than they were.
Yeah.
And there has been
a resurgence of manufacturing in the U.S., significant.
And there was also talk some years ago, and it kind of went away, of repatriating corporate profits that are being parked overseas.
And there was a tax adjustment. Mm-hmm. It's called GILTI. It's Global Intangible Blah, Blah, Blah something.
Yep.
That was a major part of the...
For those of you who want to look it up.
It's called GILTI, and it's GILTI, and tax lawyers will know what I'm talking about, and hopefully no one else, because if you do, I'm sad for you. But it basically says if you have profits that are intangible profits, or gains that are offshore, you are now taxed on them. And that is the current law.
Right.
I sadly know this because New York state tax law is a parallel. We basically follow federal tax law and we have to decouple from it. It doesn't make sense in New York that if you are making profits in other states, we're going to now add taxes in New York for that. And that would be the net effect of the GILTI provision applying in New York. And I had a very painful couple sessions working through this with the legislature who were like, but it's free money. and I'm like, no, it's not good. It punishes our manufacturers, you know. So, so that did happen. Mm-hmm. There was a lowering of the corporate tax rate. And there has been a significant resurgence of manufacturing in the country. Very muted in New York because we are in a very difficult place as far as energy policy. If you're building a new plant in New York and you don't know what your power source is going to be and, you know, when the thing is fully built, that creates a disincentive to locate your facility here. You're going to want to locate somewhere where you know what your power source is going to be. And if you sign now, you know that you can count on the fact that it will be there. I'm not saying that you can, but it's at least a little bit more certainty.
So that all points, it seems, to the that fundamental issue, that instead of a big blunt instrument of saying tariffs, and I'm going to be the king of tariffs, that what you need is a really nuanced and broad-based
and subtle motivation,
approach.
A lot of money. Mm-hmm. Buckets of money to pay for the extension of the tax bill, right? The renegotiation of the tax bill, they can't let it expire because despite what all the reporting was, if it expires, it will be a massive income tax increase on the vast majority of Americans, particularly those making under $400,000. It is a significant tax increase if it were to expire. If you remember, there used to be an alternative minimum tax that applied and you couldn't deduct. If you deduct it, so anyways, all of that went away with this tax bill and the net effect was a very significant tax reduction. People can debate all day how that, you know, impacted people because in New York, we also had the SALT removal of SALT, state and local tax deductibility, which offset those savings. So we didn't feel the tax cut the way that people felt it in other states because we're a high tax state. However, they can't let that sunset. Mm-hmm. It is hugely expensive. They need to find new revenue and they need to find it quickly, at least to have some credibility, right, for extending this bill. And I would think an across-the-board tariff is like, here's how I can drum up a couple trillion dollars, you know?
Well, actually, they found the money already.
Oh, really?
The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget did a whole breakdown of this the other day, and they
really?
Showed that they have actually, Congress has a bill, has a working draft of this.
Okay.
They have come up with $3.5 trillion in fictional money. The fictional money is, if we pass the tax cuts, we will have $3.5 trillion more to pay for the tax cuts. I think it's $3.5 trillion.
Oh, I like that.
Because it
yeah.
pays for itself, as tax cuts always
well,
have
magical
and always
thinking.
Will. Yes.
Yes, I love it.
Way down
that,
that
is. That's
way
the
down
secret.
That list.
You guys remember the book, The Secret? Like, yeah. if you manifest it, if you believe it hard enough, it will come true.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Way down that list of, you know, here are the bar chart. They have it all broken down and how many millions or billions or trillions they're going to get out of this. Way down the list is the tariffs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
the tariffs are not the.
They need real money. They, I mean,
of
you
course
can,
they,
yeah,
absolutely.
They need real money, and that's real money.
Yeah.
Like tariffs are real money. It's, but it.
But they don't get the tax cuts paid for through that
no,
real
but
money.
You have to have you have to show some new real money mm-hmm. coming in, and yeah. this is a revenue generator.
So Cleveland writes and says, could the panel comment on the fact that even with the added 25% increase in cost of goods from abroad, the prices will still be far lower than most domestic purchase options? I feel this is a known calculus by the policy creator and is simply a way to continue with revenue collection from the populace while touting a quote-unquote tax break and other segments of the economy.
I don't know that. I mean, I don't know what the price differential is depending on what the thing is, right? But I don't know. I mean, there are some avocados that are grown in the U.S. They're just not good. Like, I don't think they're more expensive. I think they're just not good because those are the big ones, right, from California.
The California ones.
Yeah, I don't like those. I like the little ones.
I don't know why I don't buy them. I don't see them in Price Chopper anymore.
I just think
they're
weird. They don't
yeah,
taste as
they
good.
Are, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, that's
well, no.
Thing.
I.
Can
is
we
that
grow,
your answer to the question?
Can we grow bananas
as
in the
soon
US?
As this
I don't.
Was,
I don't think you can yeah, grow bananas.
You know,
in
it's
US.
Clothing, like T-shirt. Maybe instead of you won't be able to get the $6 T-shirt from Vietnam anymore, and maybe you'll have to pay $22 for a T-shirt or $25 for a T-shirt. But how many T-shirts do you need? Maybe it will cut back on our consumer spending, which is atrocious. In many respects, but if your washing machine breaks, you're going to need the washing machine, and you're going to pay the price. I mean, the price is up anyway. The price of cars is up anyway. How much? I mean, not every industry will pass that tariff on to the consumer. I think that some of them will eat it, but if you love French wine, you're still going to be buying the French wine. You're just going to if you're buying French wine, maybe you can afford to outlay a couple of extra bucks.
I'll just say I love saying bought the farm. when I bought the farm that I live on, it has this super fancy refrigerator and it broke like 3 weeks ago. Like I started noticing, I'm like, the ice cubes are all wet. They seem like they're wet. And then there's no ice cubes. And then everything in the refrigerator was warm. And I was like, oh no. Cause it's like this weird size and it's super fancy. And you know, it came with the
Does
house.
It talk?
It does not talk.
Okay.
And it doesn't open the door when you wave your hand All over right. something or anything. No, it's because it's like 20 years old, but
okay.
it's a really, you know.
Still fancy.
And just a big shout out to my husband who fixed it for like $100. He like figured out what was broken. It was a compressor. He tested everything with the electronics. He got the serial number. I doubted him. I should not have doubted him. And we had to call in someone from the appliance repair place. And mm-hmm. the guy says, absolutely right. I can get you the part, but if you buy it from me, it'll be more. You can probably find it locally.
Wow.
And yeah, so I wasted a couple $100 getting confirmation of my husband's rightness. But see, you can fix stuff. People forget that. Things are fixable, but don't call me.
If they still make the parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
They didn't make the parts for our refrigerator, and I had to get a new one finally.
Oh.
It was sad.
Those two.
It was
Kenmore. Is it magical?
Kenmore.
Kenmore. Is it a magical
Kenmore.
Fridge, though? Does
Four
it, like, talk
old.
To you and do all those things?
No. No, this was the old one was we really splurged. We got all the kids have finally moved out. We got a French door behemoth,
ooh.
And it was wonderful. And this time we went back to a side by side.
I mean, people are making priced. Decisions now about should they buy a new car now? Should they replace that washing machine because
yep.
these tariffs are coming? So I think it does have subtle effects on the economy. You know, should you? I guess you can't bulk up or store up on avocados; they will go bad. But you can go and buy that case of wine you wanted. before the price goes up.
I bought three avocados. They were ten for $10, and I was like, should I get all 10? This was just before the announcement that they had worked out the deal on the 10,000 border agents.
And did you?
And I was like, should I get 10? I'm not going to eat 10 avocados before they go bad.
Well, I've noticed like recently a huge increase
in
volume of trucks, Canadian trucks moving wood.
If you have anything on Tangelos, let me know.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our conversation and a little some hints from Heloise this morning. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, Valentine's Day. 34 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we have about 15 minutes left on our watch and some time to go over a few issues with the group. Let us begin with the Senate confirming RFK Jr., a prominent vaccine skeptic, as health secretary. This vote capped a remarkable rise for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was confirmed by a Republican Senate yesterday. This was one of those that was closely watched at the very beginning of wondering whether he would actually get confirmed. And many people came out of the woodwork and said these are all the reasons he shouldn't be confirmed. And then people stopped talking about it, and then he got confirmed. Mm-hmm. So that is I'm skipping over some steps, but that's basically what happened. And there you go. What do we make of this?
You know, people thought when the Matt Gaetz nomination fell through that, people are going to be standing up for these wild and crazy people and not allowing that to pass through. But apparently that was the one and only that Matt Gaetz had so alienated everyone on Capitol Hill that they just couldn't stomach confirming him, and he had to walk away. Otherwise, it's a full steam ahead for all these nominations, despite the fact that he was a Democrat and that he has a lifelong pro-abortion position, which is not a Republican position at all. And let's go to the fact that he is a vaccine, as we call it, skeptic. And we're starting to see, even in some of the states, retrench their efforts to, you know, for universal vaccination for childhood illnesses. Let's give a shout out to Mitch McConnell, who did vote against the nomination. He is, despite the fact that Donald Trump does not quite believe that he had polio, Mitch McConnell did have polio and is a believer. People of my generation, we remember vaccines. We remember measles. We remember, and it's amazing to us that you can get a chickenpox vaccine. Yeah. I want a Lyme vaccine, you know, so I'm...
Me too.
I'll go to the pharmacy and get any vaccines they're offering. I've got them all. And the fact that he is going to be the head of Health and Human Services, I agree that our country is unhealthy, that we have a fascination with processed food that needs to be remedied. But this guy is not the man to lead us through this.
You know, you talk about the Senate and you talk about Gaetz. I had hoped that, you know, there had been talk early on that Trump was trying to convince the Senate, why don't you just all recess and I will make my appointments.
Right.
You don't need to have any part of that.
That's
and
right.
I somehow had this blind faith that if they had to stand up and be counted, that we would not see Matt Gaetz, we would not see Robert Kennedy, we would not see Tulsi Gabbard. Those are the three worst. And then today, I saw the quote from somebody that said, well, if it had been a secret vote, he wouldn't have been approved. If we didn't have to put our names on it, you did have to put your names on it. You should have stood up for the country. But, you know, this is not to be flip, but every day I walk out to my chickens and I harvest the eggs.
You got the horse, you got the chickens.
And we got chickens too. And at the top of the cage, I've ferret-proofed or weasel-proofed the cage, but birds can still get in. They can still fly in through some of the larger gaps in the wire. And I think about all those birds and I look at them and I go, you better not have bird flu. We are, from everything that I've seen, all the reading I've done, is that we appear to be on a slow increase in cases to a full-blown epidemic, if not a pandemic. If it goes beyond the United States, which it may have already done, it's going to start jumping to humans, apparently. And this is the person who is going to be guiding our national policy on potentially another epidemic. This is terrifying, and it ought to be. And the Senate should have had the American people in mind and the public health in mind before it put a vaccine denier in this position. And they're going to regret it. And the best thing I can say is, well, in 2 years, I guess we get to say we told you so.
Not a lot to add other than MAHA, make America healthy again. Doesn't that sound like the evil laugh? You know, like
MAHA. Oh, God. It's like, wow.
The bear thing. I'm still stuck on the bear thing. Like, you know, thinking about.
No.
He was going to eat roadkill.
No, the brain worm. The brain worm, to me, the brain worm overtakes
the bear. Listen, as a fellow brain worm sufferer.
Pick your disqualifying insanity.
Because the brain worm started to munch on his brain and died.
Yep.
I can't get over that. Like, if you just have a brain worm and then it's like it's working out over there, that's fine. But it was something so toxic, the brain worm died.
It died. It was sad. Was sad, but he was going to eat roadkill.
No, I know.
Come on.
I know.
Well, people do eat roadkill.
Not secretaries of health and human services. Do they really?
You know, we had the governor for an editorial board meeting the other day, and I asked her about this. Are you seeing any indication that the federal government is taking this seriously? And she did not. She's putting out press release after press release talking about how, you know, this thing is you know, such a, she's taken this action, that action. It looks like the states are pretty much doing this on their own. This is not how you handle a national crisis. Birds certainly don't respect state lines.
No. And apparently, if cats get it, house cats get it, it's very devastating. Mm-hmm. Like, it has really, really very dire effects and very upsetting effects on them. And, you know, I live on a farm. I no longer have any chickens. Thank you, foxes and coyotes. Mm-hmm. But I have a cat that can catch, and you would not believe it if you saw him first. He's really fat, and he's also very mean. He's the kind of cat that makes people hate cats. But I have seen him catch a barn swallow out of the air, and he eats their heads, you know. And so I'm going to, keep him inside? He's mean to people. I don't, you know. At least outside he serves a purpose.
To Jay's point, however, about the Senate, you can look at it as a body. I understand that. But Senator Bill Cassidy, Louisiana, a physician, an honest-to-God doctor who I assume understands that vaccines are important and had great concern and had many questions and said he didn't know that he could vote knowing that someone did not believe or was a skeptic of vaccines. Susan Collins then says, I'm concerned too.
She always says
this
has
is
concerns.
Really a big deal. This is a concern. And then they turn around and vote anyway.
Yep.
He did say he would follow the science.
His science or science?
I don't know. Well, that's what he said. He said, I'll follow the science. I'm not sure.
I mean, okay.
You know, the bottom line is all these guys are just doing whatever Donald Trump tells them to or whatever Elon Musk tells them to. It doesn't like they if Donald Trump tells them to support vaccines, maybe they'll support vaccines. Jay's point about the states taking the initiative on bird flu reminds me of the COVID epidemic. Mm-hmm. Remember the states? We were all out on our own trying to get, respirators and face masks. And, you know, that's one of the things that Cuomo spent a lot of his efforts on back in the day. There was no – we were looking to the CDC for that information, and a lot of times we weren't getting it. Finally, we did. But, again, it was the state response. I mean, pity the poor – pity Nebraska. Pity, you know, the state's not as powerful as New York.
Or is equipped to deal with it. Yeah. And what this feeds unfortunately, so well into a president who just thrives on chaos. And thrives on political divisions. And what we'll end up with is we'll end up with another situation potentially of red states versus blue states. And blue states will be taking precautions that, you know, mirror what we did in the pandemic. And red states will be saying, hey, let's have a motorcycle rally and some good, what do they call them, spreader events. And we end up with
spreader events.
Oh man, I'm having a
super spreader
events. Super spreader events. That's right.
And so we end up with because people don't know state lines. They go constantly across state lines, and they get on planes, and everybody gets sick on planes nowadays anyway. And as I said, birds could care less about state lines, especially as spring is coming on and we get back into a migratory season.
One more topic in a few moments that we have together, and then we'll call it a show on this Valentine's Day. I want to we'll end with the fact that the fallout continues over the Kennedy Center. The staff described the climate of fear as events drop from the calendar. This is as the president of the United States has taken over the Kennedy Center board and purged it of its leadership. Now, artists who were expected to appear have canceled their shows and have said the reason they're canceling is because of what is being done here. And so the cancellations come after the new Board of Trustees installed Trump as its new chair while also voting to terminate Deborah Rutter as president and making former acting director of national intelligence Richard Grenell the interim president.
I don't want to trivialize the Kennedy Center and trivialize the idea of I really think an aspiring autocrat taking over, a premier arts organization and reshaping all that that it means when somebody, one individual, decides to reshape this to his liking. I think that's really bad and all that. And I also want to, at the same time, say I feel like this is up there with the pennies and a bunch of other things that, to me, are the shiny objects. Compared to the more serious issues like health and human services and the weaponization of the real weaponization of the Justice Department, and it's potentially starting wars with other countries or becoming an international aggressor again, those things are big. And this, I'm just going to put it second tier, but I'm mad about it. And I think that New York. I hope that New York, I think Tish James seems to have, she has a very methodical approach to this stuff. She signed an agreement with Donald Trump. I'm going to write about this next week if nothing more happens on it. There was a settlement with Donald Trump on the Trump Foundation. He abused that foundation for his personal ends, and he was forced to sign a settlement that acknowledged all his wrongdoing, and it also said these are the limitations on you ever having anything to do with a nonprofit again, at least in the state of New York, or a nonprofit that solicits in the state of New York. And I believe this Kennedy Foundation arguably does solicit in New York because they certainly take donations from it. One of the things that he cannot do is get into a situation with a nonprofit in which the nonprofit's board is not independent. This board is entirely appointed by the president. That is not an independent board. I think Tish James has a case here to say, I'm going to hold you to that settlement and I'm taking it to court over it.
We'll give you the last word on that because we're out of time, but that's really interesting. It'd be fascinating to see what happens as a result of that. My thanks to Judy Patrick, Jay Jochnowitz, and Heather Mulligan. Thank you all very much for being with us. We will continue after the Congressional Report. Congressional Corner. Thank you. That's it.